He has a brand new album. Join us as we share this new sound with you. Radio Aphrodisia, showtime 4 to 6 p.m. every Saturday. Fresh new sound from the Congo, Kanda, Bongo Band, Kwasa Kwasa, Sukus Music, direct from the Congo.
You are listening to KPFK 90.7 FM, Los Angeles.
Welcome to Sojourner Truth. We live in a global world. We are all interrelated. So on Sojourner Truth, we bring to you news and views on local, national, and international policies and stories that affect us all. And we draw out how those of us most impacted, women, communities of color, and other communities are responding. We also discuss the relationship between art and politics. Now to news headlines.
I'm Max Pringle with these headlines. The Iran war continues with no sign of an end in sight. Iran has fired on Israel and neighboring Gulf Arab states. That's after U.S. and Israeli strikes continue to pound targets inside Iran. William Denslow has more.
Israel's hit Tehran with new airstrikes, although says it will now hold off further attacks on gas fields. Qatar's energy minister says its exports of liquefied natural gas may fall as much as 17% over the next 5 years because of Iran's strikes on the key Ras Laffan facility. The United Arab Emirates, Kuwait, Saudi Arabia and Bahrain all reported missile and drone attacks overnight. Dr. Daffod Townley, the chair of American Politics Group UK, says the timeline for US operations against Iran remains unclear.
The Iranian regime is a lot more resilient than the Americans thought, even though they've targeted the specific leaders. We've got the new Ayatollah in charge. We've seen senior members of the Iranian regime targeted. But the actual regime itself, the political structure, governmental structure, is very resilient to outside pressures.
From Feature Story News in Brussels, I'm William Denslow.
Iranian Kurdish families living in a camp inside Iraq say they're holding out hope that the Iran war weakens that country's theocracy and lets them go back home. The families have lived in exile since the 1979 Islamic Revolution in Iran, and many still cannot return home. Some younger people support Kurdish armed groups and run secret operations inside Iran. Many others scrape by with low-paid work and remittances. They mistrust foreign powers and fear being used again. They also fear Iran-backed militias. Kurdish fighters say they lack air cover and modern weapons to play any kind of meaningful role in toppling the regime. Oil prices jumped to market-shaping levels, but then eased back late in the day, helping Wall Street to pare its losses. The S&P 500 fell 0.3% Thursday after trimming an earlier drop of 1%. The Dow Jones Industrial Average lost 0.4%, and the NASDAQ Composite fell 0.3%. Stocks fell much more in Europe and Asia after the price of Brent crude briefly topped $119 per barrel, but before oil prices pared their gains late in the day. They're the latest manic swings for oil prices and stocks since the war in Iran raised worries about production troubles in the Middle East. The Treasury Department will take over portions of the nation's student loan portfolio. It's part of President Trump's plan to phase out the Department of Education. The White House is laying out a new framework that it wants Congress to use to shape national rules for artificial intelligence without curbing growth in the sector. It wants Congress to preempt state laws the administration sees as too burdensome. The Trump administration says its focus is on protecting children, preventing electricity costs from surging, respecting intellectual property rights, preventing censorship, and educating Americans on using the technology. It comes as state governments have forged ahead on their own regulations. Civil liberties and consumer rights groups have lobbied for more regulations on the powerful technology. States like California, Colorado, and others have passed their own regulations on AI, but the industry and the White House say a patchwork of rules would hurt growth in the sector. Former martial arts champion and action star Chuck Norris has died. He was 86. His roles in Walker, Texas Ranger, and other television shows and movies made him an iconic Hollywood tough guy, sparking internet parodies. Earlier in his career, he starred opposite fellow martial arts legend Bruce Lee. Norris died Thursday in what his family described as a sudden passing. They didn't release details about his death. Before he would become a star in movies and on TV, Norris was wildly successful in competitive martial arts. His tough man image became the stuff of legend, sparking Chuck Norris facts memes. Washington State's Democratic Governor Bob Ferguson signed a new law Thursday limiting facial coverings on law enforcement officers. Similar bills passed recently in Oregon and Virginia. And those are the Pacifica headlines. I'm Max Pringle.
Those were the news headlines from Pacifica Radio. You are listening to Sojourner Truth with your host, Nana Jumphy. Today on Sojourner Truth, we talk with change agent and organizer Nse Ifut about women in governance. And then Jamie Garcia, organizer with the Downtown Women's Action Coalition, about the strength and power of women living in Skid Row, and a new report. You are listening to Sojourner Truth with your host, Nana Jumphy. While the regime and its supporters on the Hill are pushing to disenfranchise millions of women in the United States with the ridiculously named SAVE Act, some women are calling for more women in governance as part of the solution. So pleased to be talking on this topic of women and governance in the shadow of the SAVE Act with organizer, political and cultural strategist, and change agent Nse Ifut. Greetings, Nse. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Oh, it is a pleasure. Hello, Nana.
It is always great to talk with you, and especially when we're talking about power. Power, using the power of the people. It's one of our favorite topics. And wanting to think in terms of women and power. We're seeing this conversation that is happening in this country. And of course, I want to talk globally as well, but it's happening in this country about, you know, the electability of women, and in particular, Black women. I think the conversation about women in elected spaces has kicked back up again in ways that, you know, some good ways, some not so good ways. And so, firstly, I think a question just to start us off with is like, why do we care? Like this conversation around women being in elected positions, beyond the just straight representation, oh, there's a woman there, why does it matter?
Yeah. I love this question because it is about governance, right? It's about how we run our cities, states, countries, and foreclosing or ignoring, excluding half of the population is in fact ridiculous. One, I think two, when we think about the world that we want to build, a world that recognizes our humanity, that the world that we currently live in is one that's been based off of like a patriarchal system, and that has been really, really harmful. That governance that excludes a majority of the population, governance that dehumanizes people is unsustainable. It's not sustainable in terms of, you know, our lives, the institutions that we build, and when these institutions don't work for folks, when they don't work for women, then they don't work for families, then they don't work for communities, they don't work for us. And so it is sort of the great work of my life to make sure that women and femmes and families are not just considered, but are central to the policies that we're trying to put forth and the power that we need to build, the power to stop bad things from happening, but also the power to shape the world that we want to live in. It is necessary. It's crucial. I feel like this is the work, this is my work, and I'm really proud to be doing it and proud to be doing it with these women leaders.
I think about, as you were talking, I was thinking about how we have, across so many cultures, including in this United States, right, in terms of some of its dominant culture, this idea that when something goes wrong in a household, that, people are like, where's your mama? You know what I mean? Like, there's this conversation about women and the influence and the power of women in the home, in the community. But then suddenly, when it comes to governance, it's like, who are they? How can they be in charge?
Right.
What's going on? Right. Never. And, they're too emotional. They're too this. Meanwhile, we got a temper tantrum in chief that is just making decisions. And clearly not the only one. Like, people like to make it seem that this is the only person, but this is how this system has been operating with this majority of men in charge. And no one is worried and complaining, or not no one, but you don't hear the narrative that somehow these women that can operate in the household, operate at the workplace, operate at the community level, are also as equally able to operate in the space of governance.
Absolutely. I think that it's because people want to leverage the value of women's labor without actually compensating them for it.
Ooh, they want a word.
It's just true. And you can trick somebody out of their spot by pretending like what they bring to the table, and again, their labor isn't valuable. And it most certainly is. When we think about the uncredited, uncompensated labor of, holding a family together, feeding them, holding a community together, remembering people's birthdays, that there's just so much that is dismissed or marginalized as women's work that is, in fact, like, really essential to how we're, how we hold society together. I also think that, there's so much when we think about sort of an androcentric world, like a world that was built for men. I learned the other day that, like, it's not that I can't do push-ups, that there is a way to position your hands that, takes into account the female anatomy, and that if we just slightly pivoted our hands, that it made it a lot easier. I think about medications and clinical trials that are done primarily on men, that where the medication or the treatment doesn't have the same impact on women. There's so much that we lose out on as a society and our institutions when we keep women's leadership and women's voices and priorities out of the mix.
You are listening to Sojourner Truth, and we are speaking with political strategist and power builder extraordinaire Nse Ufot about women in governance and why it matters. when you were talking about that, I was thinking and trying to, you know, I got to get with you on what that hand thing is we need to do, because those push-ups be hard.
But also
thinking about the structures of governments themselves,
mm-hmm.
right? That what if it's not just women in positions of governance, which are really important, but women also helping to determine how governance happens, what governance looks like, what yeah. government structures are. Because yeah. when you look at structures in the United States and, of course, globally, we find so many of these structures are patriarchal in their core, yes. right? And so even some of the basics of considering a non-linear way of approaching policy, for example, is mm-hmm. something that, I don't want to be too stereotypical in terms of how women think, et cetera, but just another way of functioning that is specifically anti-patriarchal, for example, and pushing government to do that. That's not going to happen if you don't have women in governance.
Correct. I mean, I think about the rhetoric about, you know, pro-family or family first kind of governance that you often hear out of the mouths of conservatives, like conservatives from any party. But then when we sort of pull on that thread a little bit, okay, so family leave, right? Education. Universal child care, universal right. health care, right? Like these things are, in fact, family supporting policies. Where the rubber would meet the road, and it is, you know, it's like pulling teeth to get conservatives to like actually live their values, actually govern with what they say their values are. And that is also quite gendered. Now, what I will say is that there are 100% conservative women that, you know, contribute to this harm and contribute to this distance between the rhetoric of being pro-family and the reality of governing like you're pro-family, that it's not just men who perpetrate that harm, but it is patriarchal and it is in the service of men, even if there are occasionally women who are contributing to it and perpetrating it.
No, absolutely. Very, very important point. Very, very important point. Thinking about outside of the United States mm-hmm. and how you have had women that have been presidents or a head of state under whatever name that person has in various countries on the continent, mm-hmm. in the Caribbean,
yes.
in Latin America, in Asia. Yes. Somehow the United States don't seem to be able to do that. They get traumatized about a governor. You know, they want to fall out.
Listen.
What do you think is at least a couple of the differences? Because again, I mean, you know, if you go to these countries, you're going to find that they also have patriarchal societies, but somehow they seem to have figured out that you can have a woman be the head of state and you won't die. What are a couple of those?
Not only will you not die, but there's also evidence that you will live longer. I remember looking at a study. I'll drop it to you after this, but about during COVID. And countries where the head of state or the head of government was a woman, and the mortality rates compared to countries that were headed by men, like it wasn't even close. Like women kept their countrymen and women alive.
Wow.
During a global health crisis, during a pandemic. So I think there's that. I think there are a couple of things at play. Yes, you know, male supremacy and patriarchy are global phenomena. But when you look at some of these countries and how their federal government is elected, right? So there's parliamentary systems of government. There's the congressional system of government. There are places where there are multiple parties. And so women who rise through the ranks of leadership within their parties in a country where there's multiple parties, parties and multiple ideologies being represented, there has also been opportunities for women to be, again, head of state in the presidential system and head of government and the parliamentary system. And so the U.S. and its two major parties with its 330 million people, 150, 160 million voters, is a really backwards system that's not actually designed to be representative of the folks who live here, who vote here, who pay taxes here, et cetera. We have to think about, you know, what how enfranchisement began in this country, white, male, and property owner, right? And it has been an uphill battle throughout the history of the United States to get to the place where you owning property, you having a penis, or you being white are not sort of indicative of whether or not your voice should be heard and included when we start thinking about how we govern ourselves. I think, you know, I'm a huge fan of Ellen Johnson Sirleaf, and she was the first elected female president in Africa from Liberia. And it has been quite some time since another woman has been elected. So even in places where they have broken that glass ceiling and elected women as heads of state, that it's still not normalized, that it's still remarkable. And that just tells me that we have a lot of work to do.
So even when you look at countries that have declared that half of their parliament or legislative body is going to be women in order to reflect the over a little over 50% of their population that are women, that's still few and far between. I mean, I think it's like one or two countries on the continent that's like 54 countries, right? It's like it's one or two. And I don't know, you know, I don't know where else that is actually happening, which just seems really bonkers in 2026.
I mean, when you, globally, women only hold about 25% of parliamentary seats, and Rwanda is the global leader, and over 60% have female representation in its lower house. But it's also constitutional, right? That it is written into Rwanda's constitution that they have gender parity in their national legislative bodies. And so, yeah, there's a lot of work to be done. And there's even, when you think about global trends, I think that they say 2063, 2065 is when we can expect gender parity in national legislative bodies. And it's ridiculous.
It's a long time from now. And say, will I be here? Let me try to
calculate. Come on.
That's a long time from now.
It's ridiculous. And it's such slow progress. And so I think that we can absolutely accelerate that timeline. But yeah, reaching gender parity is a challenge in most nations, in most countries. There are strong numbers, like I said, in Africa, I think Cuba, Nicaragua, Mexico, they all have like high parity, but we still have work to get to 50% in most countries in the world.
And what role do women play who are organizing? We have so many women, you and I both know this, that are organizing around electoral power, be it folks that are, you know, the volunteers, they're people that are paid canvassers, people that are actually doing the strategic work, people that are doing the trainings, pulling people together. I mean, there are women and femmes all over, you know, this space. What can we be doing to get some folks to be encouraged to actually run, and then for us to support those women who run?
Yeah. I ask. right? I think in our organizing, you're constantly coming across women who lead in sort of non-traditional spaces when we think about what public leadership can and should look like. I know a long time ago, I think it came from Emily's List, used to offer this stat that like you had to ask a woman an average of 7 times before she said yes to running for office. And for men, you don't have to ask at all. I don't know where those numbers stand today, but I imagine that they aren't that much better. And so ask feels really important. And, you know, viability, give them money. One of the things that is used to discredit or disqualify women is whether or not they can raise money in order to compete. Now, while we are also working on, you know, a revision of campaign finance laws and getting rid of Citizens United so that money isn't as determinative in our elections as they are currently, in the meantime, we can support these leaders by giving them money and giving them money early. And it's not, you know, I work for a living. I come from a working class background, so I'm not maxing out to candidates like that. But the earlier that you can support someone, that early money, they say early money is like yeast. It makes the dough rise. And so that's the acronym for Emily's List. And I think that it is important that small dollars, like a show of faith, sets a strong foundation for accountable leaders, leaders who would do a good job representing working people, working families' interests, who also work for a living, right? That these high net worth individuals shouldn't be the only ones who have the ability to engage in public service.
Right. No, absolutely. 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 Well, we're going to be asking. Thank you for that one. I'm going to be, I got 2 or 3 people in mind across this country. I'm like, I better start asking. Maybe I'll ask them the 7 times all at once to see if that.
Whenever I come across a faith leader, a really good mom, like a teen mom, I'm always agitating and asking them if they've ever considered running for office. And sometimes they're like, girl, bye. But every now and then they're like, actually. Right. And yeah, it is a pleasure. It's a joy to see women lead and communities and families be actually represented in the halls of power.
Thank you, Ensei, so much. I love seeing you lead. And thank you for giving us just this look into what is happening with women in the electoral space, what we should be thinking about, how we should be thinking about it, and how we need to be asking folks if they want to be one in that number. Really, really appreciate you. Have a wonderful rest of your day.
Same to you. Peace.
That was organizer and change agent Ensei Ufot on the critical impact that women's governance could have in such a time as this. More with Jamie Garcia on Power Building with Women of Skid Row after this station break.
Thank you.
listening to Sojourner Truth with me, your host, Nana Jumpy. I'm glad to be joined now by Jamie Garcia, organizer with the Downtown Women's Action Coalition at the Los Angeles Community Action Network, also known as LACAN, to discuss an exciting report about to drop, co-developed and co-written for and by women living on Skid Row. Greetings, Jamie. So glad to have you on the show.
I am so happy to be here with you, Nana.
Wanted to have you on. I'm really interested as we are looking at what is happening with women during this Women's History Month, and of course, focusing particularly on Black women, women of color, on women who are oft ignored, and that are unhoused women, women living in Skid Row. So I know that there is an exciting report, an impactful report that has just come out that I would love for us to talk about. Tell us a little about this report. You know, what is it about? Why was it important to get this information together and to highlight the women of Skid Row?
Yes, we're so excited over here with the Downtown Women's Action Coalition at Los Angeles Community Action Network to be sharing with everybody throughout the city and the county of Los Angeles and, you know, the state of California about our report that specifically, and I mean this specifically, focuses on women living in Skid Row. And why that's so important is that Skid Row in itself is the largest concentration of unhoused and poor people living in the United States. And knowing that itself, it deserves the attention and the concern, quite frankly, of people throughout the nation to understand and to address this abandonment that's happened in this community. But this report is really focusing on women, and oftentimes, what happens at Skid Row gets disappeared into larger numbers that focus on unhoused populations in the city and the county and in the state. And what we're really trying to do is highlight the experiences and the needs of women in Skid Row. So this report is taken over about 2 years, where we have not only interviewed over about 200 women through focus groups, through interviews, through surveys, and we've basically acquired a really depth of understanding, not only how women have come to Skid Row, some born and raised here, some traveling here from other states, some coming from just local cities within the county of Los Angeles, but what that journey was, what that journey entailed, and also what has happened when they've gotten to Skid Row, what kind of services they received, what the institutions were like that they were in that attempted to help them, and really what services were not available. And so we really wanted to highlight not only how well organized women are in Skid Row, how they care for each other, how they have worked through generational poverty, but really how they're very clear about what their needs are. And really, the city needs to be listening to what women are saying, because women are very clear, not only clear about the different conditions that have brought them to Skid Row, but very clear about the things they need to help them back into a house, help them reconnect with their children, reconnect with their families, and really live their best selves and their best lives.
Really, really important. You know, I think often about how people just talk about Skid Row, but then they're not really talking about Skid Row. Like, you know, as you said, it gets blurred out. And yet we're talking about really a community, right? That is not just people who are unhoused and then that all becomes Skid Row, but actually a specific community that is dealing with specific conditions and has specific needs. And so this report is so important. Also really impressed with how the information that it becomes part of this report was gathered. You know, so often we find our, you know, these reports are extractive in the way that data is pulled.
And I know over, you know, where we are, where I am at Black Alliance for Just Immigration, it's something that we are constantly thinking about. How are we doing reports about people without doing it over them, around them, right? How, and it's not easy. It takes a lot of work. You all did it in a way that really, how you were able to, how folks shared the information, how this really became this community participatory.
Yeah, that's something that we're really proud of over here at LA CAN, and just a principle that we have, because, you know, traditional academic papers, and this is no shade, for lack of better words, but sometimes academics will come out with a report and, you know, we see the extractiveness, the taking of information and the leaving the community once the information is gathered, and the writing of a beautiful report or peer-reviewed article that then they disseminate and becomes a part of a career. But at LA CAN and with DWAC, what's really important is that we center power building. And when we center power building, that means that people are a part of a process that helps them achieve their goals. And part of this report is not just for us to sit and to write and to gather this data and talk about the conditions. You know, you can walk down the street and you see the conditions. It's not a surprise when you live every day in Skid Row, when you drive through Skid Row, what is happening, the abandonment that's happening. But for us, a report means action. A report is a pathway to action, action to move power, to use our power to move power, right? The policymakers and the decisions. So the decision makers. And so part of this report was not only to write it, but to be in it, to be a part of it. And so that meant that it was participatory. And so it was participatory beyond just coming together with women and talking about the need to write the report, as we spoke about before, but came the process of, okay, how many people are we going to interview? What kind of focus groups are we going to have? So women and DWAC helping us make these decisions about who and how were we going to gather this information? And so, like, that was the first step, like the design of the research. And then from there, not only did we have the participants in the focus groups, in the surveys, in the interviews, but afterwards, because this is a mixed method, right? We are doing survey and we're quantifying our survey results. We're doing these interviews and the focus groups, and we're coding, you know, the interview, looking for themes. And then we're analyzing it. And so we had, so throughout this process, we had several, what I'd like to say, stopgaps, where we checked in with all of DWAC, you know, not only those who were participating in report meetings, because we had our women's needs assessment research team that included not only students, folks from USC, not only DWAC members, but all of us came together to do this design. So we had these stopgaps, right? So I remember after the interviews were done, it was like accomplishment, right? We got the interviews, we got the surveys, now what? So we had several sessions where we sat with women and we learned what it meant to code an interview. What does it mean to find meaning in an interview, right? So women learned the process of reading the report. And I have to say that I was along the ride with everybody else.
I would have been along the ride too.
So yeah. I did not know what coding was. I did not know what a thematic analysis was. And we would sit and have sessions, and USC students would break it down for us, you know, in several sessions, learning how to code. Then from the codes, we learned how to build themes. And then from the themes, we took all the themes that we developed and we created the story, the pipeline to homelessness. And we created that together. And that was such an amazing component of just the focus groups and the interviews, right? But then let's kind of add more to this. women also wanted to be a part of the data collection, right? So we actually had a full weekend where women in DWAC took us on a tour through Skid Row and pointed to us areas that were safe, areas that had art, area that had food, area that had women ran businesses, areas that that they said, this area is kind of, we don't walk here because the men aren't as friendly and, you know, don't support us in these spaces. And then we drew a huge map where we mapped all of that. And from there, women also collected stories, interviewed other women, collected photographs. So everyone was learning how to engage the community to well represent what it means to be a woman in Skid Row, what the needs are, and what the conditions are like. So everyone played a role in that. And then towards the end of the report process, the writing became, you know, and we had several writing circles where women took the data and they went through it. They went through the stats. They went through the themes that were the thematic analysis that was completed, and they started to write parts of the report. Some women contributed their own stories again. Some women contributed a poem. Some women completely wrote huge sections of the report. And I got to be a part of that process, learning how to write, learning how to code, learning how to analyze. So that kind of culmination of teamwork, of really bringing everybody in and everybody who's involved was amazing. And we're also having a return meeting where we're inviting participants that chose to leave us their contact information to come back to LA Can and hear the results of the report and let us know if we got it right.
Wow.
And so it was a whole method that was built on principle, that was built on us getting somewhere. So that's the last piece I'll end with, is that the report being written by itself again isn't the end of it, right? We now have our policy and our campaign building meetings within the Downtown Women's Action Coalition that are taking the results of the report and building a women's campaign. And well, that is the difference. That is the difference, you know?
Yeah. Yes, absolutely. That is the difference, you know, having the information for the sake of having a mine for other people to go and dig into. Right. And extract from, and having a report that actually becomes the engine to action. You are listening to Nana Jumphy. I am the host of Sojourner Truth, and we are speaking now with Jamie Garcia, organizer with the Downtown Women's Action Coalition at the Los Angeles Community Action Network, our comrades over at LA Can. Talk with us about, before we get to what campaigns, what other things can come out of this, and have the women said they would love to see come out of this, give us like two or three highlights that you think really important for folks that are listening right now to know about women in Skid Row, based upon the information that was shared in this participatory way that you've just described.
Yeah, so I think one of the most important things that we really approached in this report is really challenging the narrative of who is in Skid Row. And not just that there's women that are becoming increasingly a part of the unhoused community, a part of Skid Row, but how someone ends up there. And like I said, the report is really about the pipeline to Skid Row, the pipeline to being unhoused. So what we found in the report is really that there's this generational displacement that was going on. And in fact, what we found in the report was about 47% of women had already experienced being unhoused prior to living in Skid Row. So this idea that houselessness just falls on people because of poor choices. They, you know, they're not paying rent, they're not working, or whatever other issues they have on. What we discovered is that a lot of women had experienced this type of displacement before. So that's really key to like when we think about houselessness, is that not only are they currently experiencing in their life, they grew up experiencing, a large majority of women that we interviewed grew up experiencing it. And so it, and we were not obviously able to ask their families as well, but did their lineage also from grandparents to before that, you know, experience houselessness as well, food insecurity, you know, all the things that we know, the social determinants of health, people need to thrive and to be their best. Were they also experiencing that as well? But we know that they were experiencing houselessness. Another thing that is very apparent to us who work and live in Skid Row is that it's a Black community. 51% of our survey respondents, and we had about 143 surveys that we were able to complete for this report, were Black women, 24% being Latina or brown women. So that's also something that we see, this racialization of houselessness. And then also food insecurity was a very big issue as well. We had about 48.3% of women saying that they had low dietary choices, and also 63% reporting not having enough food to eat. But I think another big stat, and I'll stop here, is that there was, we see a growing population of elderly women living in Skid Row, and they are the women that have chronic conditions, are experiencing disabilities, where actually in our report, about 60% reported disabilities. But they also are talking about this feeling of isolation and this need for support. So, no, and this is just a few of the things, and these are just stats that I'm giving. There's a whole analysis that we have, and a beautiful story we have, of women really being clear. And I think this is the really key important, very clear about who they are, their choices in their lives, their responsibilities, and their accountability, who they're accountable to. But it's the systems and the institutions around them that are failing them. Where, you know, there was a young woman that gave a story about coming out to LA to want to, you know, try life on her own, you know, get into theater and movies and acting. And when she got here, she was set up. The money she gave, everything was, it was a fraud, a Craigslist scam. And then, so from there, then she friended someone and said that she could live in the back of the house. And then again, that system fell apart where this person took money. So this woman ended up houseless in Skid Row because of these series of events that occurred, right? And a lot of women also reported that unaffordability of housing, 40 to 56% of women across all ages reported unaffordability of housing. And so in the end, it's really economical when we think about why women are here. They're doing their best to be accountable, to work their jobs. And it's not this narrative of substance use, of mental health. These are very, as always, the reason why people are living and end up in Skid Row or end up houseless. We have to be able to also talk about the narrative around the economy and how just being poor. I mean, we're talking about 40 to 56% of all women saying because they can't afford a house before, because they can't afford rent, they're here. So I think a lot of this report is really changing the narrative of how women become unhoused and how women end up in Skid Row.
Thank you for that, Jamie. I've been thinking, as you were talking about how you have women, particularly when you talked about elderly women and just all the various vulnerabilities that elder women, particularly those who are racialized. I was about to say those of us, but I'm not there yet, Jamie, not quite. But those of us who are racialized, the, you know, how those vulnerabilities show up. And, you know, it's like if people are not working anymore, if they, you know, or hope to retire, you talked about chronic illness and disabilities, some of which are visible and some of which are not visible, and just how easy, combined with economics, things like the big ugly bill, you can find yourself on Skid Row. It's not going to be so difficult, or if you're on Skid Row, how hard it would be for you to be able to move into a house situation. What kinds of advocacy, what kinds of policy, what kinds of movement are people asking for, are these women asking for, as they were working along with you, pulling together this report? And, you know, what can we see on the horizon of possibilities coming out of this report?
I think one of the big thing is housing, right? I think that we know across the board, the only way to resolve houselessness is through housing, right? So women, again, we're very clear, we need housing. Another issue was safety. I mean, or I should say a problem was safety for women in Skid Row. And safety comes in a lot of ways, right? When we think about safety, it's not immediate, though all women, I should say, throughout the United States, throughout the world, also are fighting for our right to exist in the world without, you know, violence, right? So all women are saying that. But women in Skid Row are also saying that they need medical care that's specific to women, that, you know, is attends to people with chronic illnesses, that attends to people with disabilities. And the thing is that a lot of people who have needs that, like disabilities, chronic illness, need a special type of care as well, need care that is slow, that is meticulous, that is attentive, that is responding to your needs. Because being unhoused, living in the single room occupancy hotels that, you know, LA Can's over here fighting a big fight, making sure that we have security, making sure conditions are livable. The trauma of having to survive within an abandoned community requires now the solution, the carers of people, to be slow, to be loving, to be kind, to listen, right? So we're not just saying put up another clinic. We're saying put up a clinic that attends to us, attends to our needs, understands who we are as people, right? So there's discussions around safety. Safety comes in the form of health. Safety comes in the form of health for trans women. Safety comes in the form of decriminalizing sex work. Safety comes in the form of access to good food and water and clean water. And when I say food, I mean fresh fruits and vegetables, the right to access a grocery store. You know, if you're disabled, how in Skid Row, how are you getting to a grocery store, right? Unless you can afford an Instacart or a DoorDash, which those prices, you know, that's the right service that's fees out for that, impossible. Right. So with a lot of things that are coming down the pipeline for us as things that we are collectively thinking about and building power around for a campaign.
Yeah, very important. I mean, housing is the basis. You know, when you were saying fresh fruits and vegetables, I was thinking about how you do have folks that go down, but it's always something cooked, or it's a sandwich, or it's a, you know what I mean? It's never something that's like fresh, or rarely something that's fresh, unless you're up on that LA Can garden up on the roof, right? But otherwise.
Oh, yeah, we got our fresh fruits and vegetables and our herbs, and we're making our remedies and we're making our food. So definitely.
Yeah, but otherwise, it's very difficult. We're speaking with Jamie Garcia, organizer with the Downtown Women's Action Coalition at the Los Angeles Community Action Network. This is Sojourner Truth with your host, Nana Jumphy. And just want to close out by letting people know about an event that is coming up. Please share some information on that with us, Jamie.
Yeah, so we're having a public-facing event at the USC Annenberg Center, specifically on March 31st, 7 to 9 p.m. in room ANN106. So that's March 31st from 7 to 9 p.m. at the UC Annenberg Center. So we're really excited. It's going to be an event where we'll have a panel with women who are involved in creating and writing the report. We're going to have an art perform. We're going to have our art all over so people can look at the actual map that we designed. And we'll also have performances. So we're really excited to showcase the journey that this report was for everyone and the vision of moving forward from here now.
Absolutely, folks, please continue to support our sisters, our siblings who are on Skid Row, who are doing the hard work of surviving, but also of organizing and speaking up and advocating as well. Thank you so very much, Jamie. Really appreciate you coming on. Have a wonderful rest of your day.
Thank you. Thank you again for the opportunity.
That was movement organizer Jamie Garcia of the Downtown Women's Action Coalition at Los Angeles Community Action Network, also known as LA CAN, on power building and publishing a new report with women living in Skid Row. And that's our show. I'd like to thank our guests. I'd like to thank the Sojourner Truth team, including our dear sister, Margaret Prescott, our board operator, Ozzy Flamenco, producer, Gary Scott, and you for your continued support of KPFK and for all that you are doing to keep this station going. Let's get together at the same time and place next week for Sojourner Truth. Be well.
Peace, everybody. This is DJ Sean O, and you are listening to KPFK 90.7 FM Los Angeles. I wanted to let you know you can check out Soundwaves Radio with hosts Val the Vandal and myself each and every Friday evening from 8 to 10 p.m. right here on 90.7 FM KPFK Los Angeles.
Support comes from UCLA's Center for the Art of Performance, presenting...
Danny is an accordionist. He's dedicated his entire life to the mastery of his craft and to the preservation of the traditional music from his locality in North Kerry.
Broken Talkers Bellow, on March 20th and 21st at the Nimoy.
Feel it in my chest.
Bellow tells the extraordinary true story of one of Ireland's foremost accordionists, Danny O'Mahony. A man who has dedicated his life to the preservation of traditional Irish music and to the mastery of his craft. Tickets and further information is available at cap.ucla.edu and kpfk.org.
It shines with that. It settles that.
Hi, Hi, this is Michelle Coltrane. Join me every Saturday at 4 a.m. for my show, Awakenings. We will be taking a musical and spiritual journey into the world of Alice Coltrane and beyond. That's Awakenings every Saturday, 4 a.m. on KPFK 90.7 FM Los Angeles and online for the world at kpfk.org.
Shanti.
I'm Esti Chandler from Middle East in Focus. Author Phyllis Bennis will be discussing Understanding Palestine and Israel at Midnight Books on Friday, March 27th, and at Watermelon Books on Sunday, March 29th. Co-sponsored by Jewish Voice for Peace Los Angeles, the Institute for Policy Studies, and KPFK. Further information available at kpfk.org.